Good evening, everybody. So this is Alin, the president of the executive board. I just want to thank everybody for joining us. We'll be getting started here in about 3 minutes. I wanted to take this opportunity to recognize our platinum sponsor. I'm not really doing such a good job at that. And this month, our platinum sponsor is Steve Pedraza of Total Service. I don't remember the name. Oh, isn't that terrible? So he's our platinum sponsor this year, or this month, sorry. I'd also like to tell you guys that we are doing a Save a Doma campaign right now. And if you look at the website on the front page, there's some vendors that have given us some money. So I'd like you guys to look at that and see who our sponsors are that are helping save our chapter, our organization, rather. We are going to be hearing from Dave Reese of Fine Boggs and Perkins. He was the gentleman that was supposed to speak to us in person before the COVID hit, and he has graciously accepted my bugging invitation to do it again and do it in this format. So he's going to present, as you can see by the PowerPoint presentation on the screen, to manage the COVID, a practical approach. He's going to cover information, and he is going to have an opportunity to ask him questions. I will be monitoring the chat. So if you have a question, please let us know. You know, there's no question that is a bad question, and it does not all have to pertain to COVID-19. It could be another question. He is willing to answer whatever he can for us. So if you guys have any questions, again, just go ahead and type it into the chat, and we will get to all of the questions that we can, or all the questions that are out there. Not that we can. He said he would answer as many as we had. So I believe we are almost ready for Dave. I know he's there, but I think he's muted his mic.
No, I think my mic is working. I just haven't talked.
Oh, there you go. All right. So everybody, Dave Reese.
All right. I'm going to lead with a disclaimer, like we all shouldn't when we present, right? And actually, it's more of a denial than a disclaimer. There is no truth whatsoever to the rumor that I came up with this COVID virus as an effort to avoid speaking in person. I would much prefer to speak in person, as I think many of us have learned. You know, I think some of us have learned that we miss people, and some of us have learned that, you know, this kind of not having to be around people is not all that bad. And my guess that are those in the room with us today, there are some that fall in both camps. I am most decidedly in the camp that misses people and misses the kind of feedback that you get when you talk to real people instead of talking to a webcam somewhere. So with that, let's jump in a little bit. I had initially set up this to do some other things. Our topic list was a little different, but as my friend Mr. Farley here appreciates, they keep changing the rules on us, and by they I mean the doctors, the bureaucrats, the local and state health officials, the EDD, the DOL, the IRS, the whole game. We'll go through some of those later, but you know, everything seems to be changing on us. What happens is, you know, we were going to talk about the important thing about how do we bring our employees back now that our PPP loans are in and we want to make sure we get full forgiveness. You know, but that feels like months and months ago when that was an issue, because things keep overtaking us. You know, the government passes a PPP relief bill that allows us to kind of cool our jets a little bit on that. And now we're less worried about that. And we're more worried about this new viral surge that hits us. So I struggled with a little bit on exactly how to kind of prepare some remarks and some slides to make the best use of our time. And you know, there's no way that we're able to cover everything. You know, what we can try to do a little bit is, you know, I thought to myself, well, let's just focus on some of these agencies and governmental entities that are affecting our workplace these days. Right? You have the federal government, the state government, county government, the cities. How about your landlords? Now, most of you probably are not in an office building with other tenants. You might be if there's a headquarters building, for example, on some deal groups. But you know, my building has these weird rules. Example, like every day, I get an email from the building manager. It says, hey, yet another person in the building has tested positive. Therefore, we've scrubbed down the entire common area again, and we continue to be protecting everyone. And so we have all these different entities that are, you know, what I'll call looking out for us and trying to keep us on the straight and narrow. One thing I tried to do, I sat down for a little while until I became too depressed. And I thought to myself, okay, let's talk about some of the agencies whose jurisdictions we fall into as it comes to these COVID-related changes. And so one of the things I started with was, well, you know, you've got your DFVH and your EEOC and all their protection of civil rights. And on the one hand, they're very diligently trying to make sure that we remember that just because there's a pandemic doesn't mean that we put our civil rights on the back burner, and our right to privacy and our right to medical privacy in specifics. We're also seeing a disturbing uptick in individuals who are engaging in what I call just harassment and discrimination, making fun of people who might come from a certain ethnic group or area of the world where the virus apparently originated. So every once in a while, you see a reference to the Kung Flu. You should say to yourself, not in my dealership, we won't, because you don't want that kind of oversight and attention from the DFVH, to say nothing of the fact that it's just rude, and you know, we should be beyond plenty of that. So we talk about the labor commissioner and the Fair Labor Standards Act and the labor code and the Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division. And, you know, they care about furlough issues. You know, we've learned early in this pandemic that, you know what, California doesn't have something that we might think of as a furlough. You know, when our federal government fails to fund itself, and people end up having to stay home with no pay, they call it a furlough, and the government's okay with that, and everybody else is kind of okay with it because at the end of the furlough, they always pay everybody back. But you know, there's no such animal in California. There's a separation. If you have a furlough that's going to last more than the pay period, you've got to call it a separation. You got to pay final wages, for example. So that's one of those things we've learned in this pandemic. You know, when we reduce wages for people that come back, you know, for hourly wages, it's pretty easy. We reduce them, but we can't go below the minimum. And we know that that keeps climbing. This past month here, we've started another step of wage increases for example, LA County. Their minimum wage has gone up in July here. What about salaried employees? If we have salaried employees who are making a base salary that's at a certain level, and we bring them back for less time and less money, are we still treating the exemption the way we should? Well, we better be, otherwise we're gonna get ourselves thrown in the chokey, as my kids used to laugh about their favorite movie. And we also talk these days about the EDD. Everybody remembers how hard it was to get unemployment and stuff in the old days. It seems like, you know, they keep falling over themselves to give unemployment benefits to as many people as they can. And the federal government, in infinite wisdom, decided, let's throw extra $600 on top of that. How many of us, there's like a handful of you with cameras, but how many of us have seen you know, people that are telling us when we try to get them back, hey, you know what? I'm making more money on unemployment. Why would I ever want to come back? You know, lots of our clients have reported that kind of a response when they try to get people to return to work. And that makes it tricky to do our job. The EDD also deals with disability payments. You know, it's been fine and dandy for a lot of employees to be taking all this time off. But at some point, the 2 weeks of paid sick leave expires. And at some point, they don't have paid leave anymore. But we have work for them. And so if they're truly disabled, then that's going to be an option for them. That's keeping the EDD pretty busy. The Workers' Compensation Appeals Board and the Workers' Comp Authorities, they're keeping plenty busy these days. And I can only imagine that for them, they've got years and years worth of work ahead of them, because the government came down, the governor specifically, with a declaration that said that every employee who contracts COVID within 14 days of having worked in the workplace is presumed to have caught it at the workplace. And that makes it particularly easy for most of the individuals who do get it at the workplace to get coverage for their condition, which is handy. But at the same time, it forces on employers and their insurers costs related to COVID that have nothing to do with the workplace. You know, many of us will have by now had one of our employees sneak over to Las Vegas for a bachelor party or some other kind of gathering and come back with a sore throat and a runny nose and a fever. And hopefully they haven't blamed us for it. But the law says if they do, we have a very limited period of time within which to challenge that and to rebut that presumption. So it's something for us to keep in mind and to make sure that we move quickly when it comes up. Let's see, we talk about the Department of Labor. You know, they've given us these rules through the legislature. The federal government gave us the FFCRA, they gave us the CARES Act, and they gave us the Department of Labor to kind of help administer that. And things have slowed down a little bit, but during those first few months and weeks after it was passed, every couple of days there'd be new guidance, new FAQs coming from the government about how to interpret this leave requirement or that leave requirement. There's lots of things that we have to pay attention to on that regard. So we have to, as employers, we don't get to pick and choose which laws we want to focus on. We just follow them all. We talk about the FMLA and the EFMLA. I get questions probably every day on these sick leave laws. And so we're going to focus a little on that today. Tax credits for paid leave, you know, it's great. You know, we as employers can be as generous with our own money as we want. But the federal government and the FFCRA has said that if we're going to be generous with federal government money, we have to make sure that everybody can fit their square peg into the square hole. And so that dictates a little bit of our decision making when it comes to leaves of absence. So we pay attention to that. The SBA stuff, we're not going to talk much about the SBA today, simply because it hasn't changed much. It's been kind of put on the back burner by the relaxation law that came in, the Flexibility Act. But it's out there and we have to pay attention to it. It's going to affect us. And certainly as the 24-week period comes winding down, for those of you that have elected that period, we're going to see more and more people who have questions on that. So we're expecting that to flex up a little bit. We probably could have found more agencies, but at that point, I just became hopeless in my looking at it, because there's everybody and their dog wants to tell us how to run our business normally, and it seems to just double and triple when we're in an environment like this that's challenging, whether intentionally or otherwise. So it kind of gives us a little bit of frustration. So what I said to myself is, all right, let's just focus on the fact that we are getting call after call after call about COVID-related activities and guidance that's needed. We hear from HR managers. We hear from sales managers, general managers, here from office managers and controllers, and most all of them have questions that come down in along a fairly narrow field of questioning, and most of it has to do with symptoms, it has to do with leaves of absence, and it has to do with returning to work. What does it take for us to get back to our core business, be able to do it safely with the right people in the right places? And that's tricky. So let's start a little bit with symptom checking. So If those of you that that are following along at home with the CDC and its various guidance, you'll remember that fever was the number one symptom that that people reported early on. And for many, that was the first one. And then they added, you know, maybe a dry cough or some shortness of breath or fatigue. You know, good solid symptoms that could never mean anything else, correct? It must mean the COVID. Well, they've said, well, if four symptoms is better, is good, then let's just keep making the list longer and longer. I think I've got 11 bullet points here now, including the most recent stuff that was added in by the CDC not too long ago. And it's all about adding symptoms that are clinically appearing. And I'd have no doubt that the CDC is seeing correlation between these symptoms appearing and the workplace. But the list just continues. I found another list of symptoms here too, and I went through it I apologize. This list is for mange. This list is for my dog. So not this one we can skip. But who knows? Maybe paw problems will be the next COVID symptom that we have to deal with. You know, we just have to keep our eyes on the prize. So how do we do it? Well, one way to do it is to keep an eye on the CDC's website. They will announce things. A phalanx of doctors will take the dais, hopefully 6 feet apart with masks on, and they'll tell us about the clinical significance of a new symptom, like, you know, scratchy feet or you know, ear hair or something like that. Who knows? The other way to do it, or another way to do it, is take advantage of the symptom tracker. HR HighLink put together a symptom tracker. How many? Now, I'm not looking at the chat, so I can't get any feedback. But those of you with cameras, if you use the symptom tracker from the HighLink, then you know, do us a little fist pump here, because it's a great tool, and it gives us an opportunity to do kind of the things that we need. We need to keep track of the changing parameters. It helps us document compliance, and it makes it easy for us to have these people confirming that it's not just us that's paying attention to this. Every employee needs to be paying attention to it. So we need to be doing symptom checking. We should all have thermometers in the workplace, touchless thermometers. Remember, the employment lawyer in me has to remind everybody that we also have to pay for the time that they spend doing these symptom checks. So by now, most of us will have added a few minutes every day to the workload of every individual as they run through the list, swiping in the right direction. Now, what happens if as we're going through the symptom check, we find ourselves, I've got myself a little body ache today. Does that mean I have the COVID? Do I need to update my will? Who knows? Well, if you just have one symptom, and it's a symptom that you have regularly in a non-COVID environment, there's probably a good chance that you don't have the COVID. All right? So, for example, if you have seasonal allergies and those seasonal allergies give you body aches or a runny nose, if you ate some bad clams at the restaurant, it doesn't mean you have the COVID if you have the diarrhea. It just means that you have a symptom. So a lot of times people with chronic conditions that have symptoms already will recognize those. And as they go through the symptom checker, one of the major questions that we always get is, he says he has a headache. That means he can't come for 2 weeks, right? And the answer is, well, let's use the rule of reason. You know, it may be that the employees can come back to work right away because this is not a symptom that suggests that it's COVID related. On the other hand, if an employee has more than one symptom, or it's a symptom for which they have no history, then it's absolutely prudent to start, you know, thinking, well, maybe they have the COVID. And so we're gonna funnel them into that path. But even if it's just a single symptom and we don't think it's COVID related at all, it's not gonna hurt anybody to make sure that person is more diligent in socially distancing, in physical distancing, in cleaning of surfaces, in avoiding being unmasked near other people. So you know, we should be reasonable in our approach. If you have questions, that's one of the reasons we publish our phone number all the time, is to help people walk through this. It's a lot easier and less expensive to call us and get some advice quickly than to go down the wrong rabbit hole only to find out later when the attorney and the employee are ganging up on you, trying to line their pockets with your money. So that's one of the areas that we get a lot of questions about. Another area that we get a lot of questions about is the area of so-and-so was at a party with a friend whose cousin's uncle's grandma's manicurist has the COVID. What do I do? I'm afraid. They're afraid. We're all afraid. What do we do? Seen in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, where they're raising money for the kidney because somebody's friend's brother, sister saw that he needed a new kidney. So here, please donate. You know, there's a lot of these kind of links that are never going to be a true exposure. So one of the things we want to do is we want to talk about what is an exposure. And this can be an exposure from a coworker, from a customer, from a family member, from...
We lost your mic.
Jump from coworker to coworker. Uh-oh. Am I still there? You got me back?
Yeah, you're back. Yeah, we're back.
Okay. Did you miss much of me, or do I need to go back?
We missed about, let's see, what was the last thing you said? Something about a coworker.
Okay, yeah. So the virus doesn't discriminate against, you know, people who say, well, I couldn't have possibly gotten it from a coworker. Well, anybody who's, I guess they say it's about the droplets. Anybody whose droplets you're coming into too much contact with who has the virus could be giving it to you. And so, you know, it may be that there are home exposures or work exposures that we have to pay attention to. So the CDC guidance talks about exposures and talks about presuming the exposures if there's been, for example, actual physical contact with an infected individual. You know, there used to be, I used to say there's two types of people in the world. There's people that like to be hugged and grabbed by people in crowds, and there's me who doesn't. And so this social distancing stuff can be great at that way. But if you're in physical contact with somebody who's been infected, you're hugging them, you're helping them with hygiene because maybe it's an older person or somebody who needs extra care, then it's likely that you've had an exposure. Also, if you've shared a workstation with somebody who's infected, and I don't mean like, you know, gee, I have an old laptop that I'm using that, you know, Jerry used to use 3 weeks ago. I mean, you're working in this, you know, common cube, or you're going back and forth between a phone or a computer or something like that, then there's probably an exposure presumption. And then the other one is if you've had close contact with an individual, that means that within 6 feet or in an enclosed closet or small space for more than 10 minutes without a mask, within 72 hours prior to the onset of symptoms from the infected individual. That's where the CDC says, well, you know what? You've probably been exposed. All right. So does that mean, okay, I'm off 14 days on the beach for me? Well, not in Orange County because they keep closing them. But, you know, is it time off? Do I go in time out because I've been exposed? Well, no. The CDC, for example, says, look, as long as the employee has no symptoms of the COVID and it's not tested positive for COVID, then they can continue working even though they've had a potential exposure, right? So, but we have to be careful. Now, they have to wear a mask. They should be doing the daily temperature and symptom checking. They should not be sharing workstation equipment, phones, and the like. And they should absolutely be physically and socially distancing. Many of us by now will have outfitted our dealerships with plexiglass shields to help facilitate that. But it's all about making sure that people are not getting too close to each other for COVID to be comfortable. And then ultimately, this person should also be told to consult with their own healthcare provider. It may be that their doctor has some particular concern for them based on a medical condition, a pre-existing or comorbidity, they call it. So we have to pay attention to that, and they should be hanging out with their doctor more. These are exposed individuals, but they can still work. We shouldn't really have a problem with that. Now, if we do have a problem with that, we might tell them to self-quarantine until they follow the negative test, or it's been about 2 weeks. For example, if I have an employee who comes to me and he says, Dave, it's Monday morning, I'm not sick, but boy, let me tell you about the rave I went to down in Mexicali. It was fantastic. All right, well, maybe that's a guy I'm going to tell him to, you know, why don't you stay home for 14 days, think about what you've done. And so we can still, as employers, if there is a likely exposure and we want to be more safe than sorry, then we can still use the longer quarantine provisions. Now, think about some of the decisions that the CDC was advising way back when this first came out. Some of those can still be validly used. Now, what do we have to do? Yeah.
I've got a couple of questions. Do you want to do all the questions at the end? Or do you want
to answer? No. Look, I can only imagine how boring it is to listen to me talk. So let's jump in and get some questions on this issue. Okay. If we want to talk about exposure, if we want to talk about the earlier subjects at all.
Okay. So the question is, if you know an employee got COVID from home, but the governor said it needs to be presumed it is from work, what do we do? We are documenting it. Does it help us?
It does help us. So what happens is, if we have a workers' comp claim that comes in, and they say, well, I think I got it at, you know, the governor says I must have gotten it at work. I was at work and I got it 14 days or less after I was last at work. But if that same employee, for example, we have pictures of them on Facebook at the bachelorette party in Vegas, not socially distancing, or, you know, then we can absolutely document that. Or if they've told us, hey, look, I need time off because I'm going to Vegas this weekend, you know, or I'm going to go visit my grandmother in a nursing home in New York City. You know, absolutely, we should keep track of that and document it so we can be able to say after the fact, hey, this can't have been the case. But the rule on that declaration is the presumption that it was work-related transmission is going to apply, and it's going to stop us from being able to contest that using evidence that we knew ahead of time. If we don't make a contest and we challenge that and we deny the claim early enough, within, say, 30 days, I think is the number. So we should make sure that if we have a workers' comp claim come in, we should absolutely contact our workers' comp carrier to make sure that the adjuster or the attorney handling the case knows that, hey, we have this information to confirm that this is not a work-related transmission. Does that make sense? Does that answer the question?
Okay. So, Colleen, if you could tell them if that was the answer, if that helped you, or did you need more information? And then the next question was, so you can say if they do not have symptoms, but someone at their house has it, can they come to work?
So if someone has symptoms and someone at their house has it, if they don't have symptoms, rather, and someone has it, then they have a potential exposure. And so the CDC says, yes, they can continue to work in these essential functions that are still open right now, provided that they follow these rules. They make sure that they're doing the symptom checking. They're not sharing stations. They're taking their own temperature on a daily basis to make sure that nothing is sneaking in. And as long as we can do the physical distancing and the social distancing and all of the protective guidance of the CDC, then they can work. We can have them work.
Okay. Does anybody have any more questions about what we've talked about so far? She's asking, was that a recent change?
That's a change that's come out. The CDC has made it clear that that works for people in critical infrastructures. And in a dealership environment, certainly for a while, the only people that were working were in critical infrastructure positions. And so in that regard, it's not particularly a new change. I think that as more and more people and more offices are opening, it's becoming a little bit more spotty as to whether everybody's a critical infrastructure worker. But for example, as we continue to watch the changing dynamics, I think in LA County or in California broadly, they've indicated that non-essential offices should close. I read that this week. And so effectively everybody that's coming to work for us is almost now by definition going to be essential. They'll fall into that category. But again, if the employer has to balance between maybe putting somebody at home for 14 days, because you know the efficacy of the work that what you get from the individual is not worth the risk, even though they haven't shown any symptoms yet, then the employer can continue to require people who have these potential exposures to stay out for 14 days.
Another question was, can we require them to bring a doctor's note clearing them to come back to work?
Okay, so initially the word on that was absolutely no, because it was so difficult to get in and get a doctor's note from anybody. We're going to talk return to work kind of later on in the seminar. So there's okay. a few slides we'll get to not too long from now okay. that do walk through the return to work protocols. There's essentially two. One is a test-based, and one is a what they call a time-based protocol. And so we should we'll get to that in a bit. I don't mean to defer it too long.
No, but that's fine. Okay, and then there's one more question. It says, we had an employee for a weekend trip. We had an employee from a weekend trip with her friends. Can we isolate her in a different room when she comes back on Monday? So they have an employee that's gone away for the weekend. When she comes back on Monday, can they isolate her in a different room?
You know, that's an interesting question. So what it's related to, it's related to questions like, hey, my employee went to Mexico. What should I do when they come back? And the answer there is the guidance for travel like that still says that that people traveling in areas internationally or traveling in areas where exposures are likely should stay home for 2 weeks or self-isolate for 2 weeks. Now, but as we talked earlier, and there's some slides on it early, as we go into this this reasonable approach, it's not necessarily all or nothing. So for example, you know, we can have somebody who's traveled out for the weekend make sure that they wear their mask 24/7 during their time that they're at the workplace. Hopefully not 24/7, because those days are over, but, you know, 8x5, you know, we'll call it that. So we can have them mask up when they're in the facility. You know, some people like myself, I mean, I'm in my office, but I've taken off my mask because I'm in a private office. My door is closed and there's nobody coming in and out. So that's not an issue. But for this person, for example, if it's required or beneficial to socially distance and physically distance by moving this person to a different room or having them wear a mask, as long as we have a legitimate business reason for it and it's work related, then we should not have a problem asking this person, hey, in light of that, for the next bit here, we're going to need you to work in the annex or in the other room or something. As long as it's not a punitive action, but it's reasonably and directly related to the health and safety issues, then I don't have a problem with that.
The question that came up with what you were talking about, is it with or without pay if they are required to isolate for 14 days?
Okay. Generally speaking, it's going to be without pay. If I were out in a non-COVID environment and I came down with a raging case of chicken pox and had to stay home to avoid sharing it with everybody, I could use my vacation. I could use my state-provided sick leave 3 days. But I wouldn't be able to demand that the employer pay me to go home and do nothing. Now, if the employee has qualifies for the leave under one of the several different paid leave categories, then it would be a different answer. So for example, if the employee has come back from someplace, they've consulted their physician about it, and their physician has said, for your safety, Dave, I think you should self-quarantine and self-isolate for 14 days. Then they should come to us. They should request leave using the leave request form. And you can get that on the employer lawyer's website if you haven't already. And you request the leave. You take the time out. And we get to then pay them based on the second criteria, which allows us to say an employee who's been advised by a doctor to self-quarantine is eligible for paid sick leave under the FFCRA. Similarly, if they are out because they're taking care of a family member who has COVID and we ask them to stay out, they would probably qualify under the fourth item, which pays them to be out taking care of a family member during this period of time for, in this case, again, up to 2 weeks. In the latter situation, they only get 2/3 of their pay, whereas the former, they get all of their pay subject to statutory caps. And so if you have specific questions about that, we're happy to take them. We share our phone number liberally, and we've answered an uncounted number of phone advice calls just like that. Mm-hmm. We're happy to kind of do that. Hopefully that gives us enough of an overview of the question on that, though.
Okay.
We'll come back to more questions in a bit. So we've talked about the leave request forms. You know, we should make sure that if somebody is going to be out on leave, that we make sure that they're on leave and that they have the forms for it. So if we have somebody that's testing positive or showing symptoms, you know, they're gone. This is not why don't you work for the rest of the day here to finish the payroll and then leave? You know, this is I'm sorry to have to say this, but you can't be here if you're sick. So we should send them home right away. And we should refer them to their healthcare provider. Now, that doesn't mean rush off to your doctor. That means, you know, reach out to your doctor. Find out because you can go out and get yourself tested fairly quickly, hopefully.
The last thing we heard is says, don't rush off to your doctor, but reach out to your doctor.
Right, so reach out, find out. I use Kaiser. Kaiser has a lot of telemedicine. I can send an email to my doctor. I can call the nurse helpline. I can do a lot of things before I have to actually go out and do something. I had a medical issue come up, non-COVID related, around the end of May. I'm on the phone. I'm talking to him. I'm explaining to him. They said, we'd be happy to see you. Just come to the such and such facility where we don't have COVID patients, and you'll get right in. And it was great. He was right. I got right in. So in that regard, they should reach out to their doctor, their healthcare provider. Let's see. Why am I? There we go. So one of the other things that we do, if somebody does come down with symptoms, we want to absolutely take a look and see, you know, how do we identify and inform people of this close contact that may have had close contact with this person who's come down with symptoms. Again, close contact is where there's actual physical contact, or, you know, a household member, or you've shared workspace with them, or you've spent time for more than 10 minutes within 6 feet without masks on. Right? If you've had close contact, you should go back and look. Initially, it was 48 hours. Now they're kind of saying, now look, 72 hours before the symptoms appeared, and that's the window. So if your employee calls you on Monday morning and said, you know, I woke up this morning with a headache, and I can't taste or smell anything anymore. Okay, probably symptoms. Right? So did they work within the last 72 hours? Well, they've been off since Wednesday because they had a couple of days off. Well, that's not somebody you have to worry about having infected your people, according to the CDC guidance. But you look through and you figure out, okay, who would my employee now have had close contact with, as defined in here, within the last 72 hours before they had symptoms appear? And so we go through and we look at that, and we find out that we have somebody like that, that we should make sure that we treat them as though they have had a potential exposure. Now, remember, we just went through those. They don't have to stay away, but they should be masked. They should be socially distancing. They should be physically distancing. They should be doing the symptom checking. They should be taking their temperature and being in touch with their doctor. Guess what? We're all doing that anyway, if we're doing it right. So there's not a lot that needs to change for people, even if they have this suspected exposure from somebody who came down with it. We should spend the time and the effort to make sure we're disinfecting and doing a good cleanup on the areas that the employee would have worked in during that, especially during that window of 72. All the common areas where they were, like I said, my building sends me an email every day, or just about every day, saying that somebody in the building has tested positive. And so their suite and all the common areas that they would have had access to have been wiped down and disinfected yet again. There's a small army of maintenance and custodial people that are swarming the building, doing things like that here. And most dealerships have assigned a number of people to do that, whether it's the guys who used to drive the shuttles, other porters, or outside vendors. You know, lots of people are doing that. So when somebody does test positive or become symptomatic, then we have to follow the return to work protocols. We're going to talk about that in a minute. And then if there's a workers' comp element where we think there's a risk, we should make the report. And specifically, if we think it's going to be close, report it right away and make sure you tell your workers' comp people that, hey, this one we don't think is really a workplace transmission, and here's why. You know, we usually, you know, I look forward to the days when we talk our workers' comp people about new claims. It's because we tell them that we think it's malingering rather than, you know, we tell them that we think that they got it someplace else. Those days will return for us when this crisis ends, but for now, this is the guidance. OSHA reporting. We get a lot of questions about OSHA reporting. When do we have to do it? When, you know, do we, you know, I feel bad. What are we going to do? Well, if there's no indication that it was a work-related transmission, there's no requirement to notify OSHA about it. The OSHA requirements are 3 points. If it's a confirmed case, not just a suspected case, if they had to seek medical treatment or be away from work, which most confirmed cases will all be, and if there's evidence that it was contracted by the employee at work or it's work-related, those are when we have to make the disclosure to OSHA. And that's not going to be very often. Now, if you have 5 people all of a sudden come down with something, maybe you should look at it again, all right? And then you should also pay attention to this one. This one's a relatively new piece. Our friends in Los Angeles County have told us that, hey, if you have 3 people test positive within a 14-day period, then you have to tell the local public health authorities. Right? Other counties may already have that, or they may soon fall. But that's what the scenario in LA is right now, so we pay attention to that. Most cases, we don't need to shut down a facility or even a department. But if there was, for example, multiple people, or if there are other indicators that suggest that maybe this person could have created more of a mess medically, then we probably want to go ahead and do some heavy duty disinfecting. You know, a lot of stores we're finding, you know, they're closing earlier, not necessarily because they don't like our money, but because they want to make sure they have time to clean and sanitize facilities. So we should be making sure that our facilities are appropriately sanitized. Open the doors, they say. You know, if it's been 7 days since the employee came in, you're probably not going to get anything out of it. But if it's less than 7 days, you think about it. And again, an outbreak where there's multiple cases, maybe you even want to close it a little bit, have people stand, you know, go out and get a little testing or isolate themselves a little if we think that that we can, by doing that, you know, avoid a larger outbreak. So again, anybody that gets symptoms during this period of time, once they have the symptoms, they get into that return to work protocol. Well, let's talk about this again, because there are these two protocols that the CDC has published as the manner in which to return to work, all right? One is the time-based protocol, and then one is the symptom-based protocol, and one is the testing protocol. So the symptom timing protocol is this. If you have your employee out, if they come down with symptoms, they have to be out for at least 10 days. All right, that's the soonest they could ever come back is 10 days. So if they get sick on July 1 with symptoms, they cannot come back until July 11th. They have to self-isolate until July 11th. But it could be longer. Now, when is it longer? It's longer if the employee has had the symptoms last longer, because they have to be symptom-free for at least 3 days in order to come back. So it's the greater of the 10-day period or until they've been symptom-free for 3 days. And symptom-free in this context doesn't mean that, you know, everything's all rosy. It just means that the fever is gone and there's no medication used to drive the fever down anymore. And other symptoms that you might have, the taste issues, cough issues, they have become diminished and they've slackened a bit. That will allow you to come back. So as I said in the example, if somebody finds out on July 1st that they're sick and they have no symptoms at all after July 1st, maybe it's the 2nd, then they can come back on the 11th. But if their fever and other symptoms don't abate until the 9th, then they can't come back until the 13th because they have to be 3 days clean, right? So those are the symptom timing protocols. Those are the ones that most of us will follow most of the time. In fact, for many, until testing had become more available, that was realistically the only way to do it. So they also have the testing protocol. Now, the testing means that you have to have, the swab test, you have to get negative tests, two consecutive tests, and they have to be sampled at least 24 hours apart. So that becomes important. And why it has to be, I looked at the CDC guidance again this afternoon. They used to say specifically the protocol you had to use to get the test, but now their guidance says, look, follow whatever the current protocol is for the molecular testing. So we're testing in the respiratory tract. We're not counting antibody tests, and we're not counting other kind of serology testing if there are any others. This has to be the specific respiratory testing that's been done. If any of you have done it, the one I did involved a really, really long Q-tip that I'm pretty sure poked outside the back of my head when they went in through my nose. It's not a fun test. And so because it's not fun and because it's hard to get there and there's still a limited number, if you have no symptoms and you go to your doctor and say, okay, I need to get COVID tested, they may tell you no. If you go to your doctor and say, I need to get COVID tested today again, even though I got COVID tested yesterday, because I need to be able to show that I'm clean, they're going to go, look, I got a bunch of sick people I need to test. I can't just use this. So for most employers, most of the time, it's going to be the symptom-based return to work protocols that are used. So a couple other questions that had come up as I was going through this. What do we find out that we have an employee that's particularly susceptible? For a while, I think it's Ventura County, if I'm not mistaken, they had a rule that says, look, you don't have to shelter in place unless you're 65. Then you can't go anywhere. All right. Now that is age discrimination. And while the city of Ventura and County of Ventura may think they can get away with it, and that's between them and their lawyers. But from our perspective, employers are not going to get away with that. So we can't just take people and say, look, you fall in this risky category because of your age or because of your obstructive pulmonary condition, your diabetes, your asthma. We're going to just treat them like everybody else. We don't unilaterally force people to go home. Now we might tell them, look, according to the guidance, you should be particularly careful. And this is what we're doing to make sure that we're protecting ourselves and our employees. But hey, if your doctor, you should check with your doctor. And if your doctor says you should stay home, then maybe you stay home. But we definitely can't force them to stay home just based on that. And we talked a little bit about this here. People are making $1,000 a week to be home. Not bad money for not getting anything done. I have a son who is unemployed right now, and he's not taking unemployment because he was kind of unemployed before. And he's got a buddy down the street who told him, hey, I'm getting like $1,600 a week in unemployment, and it's fantastic. I just built myself a new fancy computer. And my son is growly and grumbly, and figures he could probably go file for unemployment, but he's not out, unable to work because of the COVID. He's unable to work because he is addicted to his video games and he plays video games too much. That's what's keeping him home. And so, we're going to see a lot of abuse like that. But the trick is, if we want these people to come back, we just have to make sure we give them an offer in writing. We have to make sure that we explain to them that they're not really going to be at risk, right? We have to show them the things that we're doing. The EDD is normally saying, look, if your workplace isn't safe, then maybe it's not a reasonable, comparable employment. And I'm going to go ahead and give them the unemployment anyway. So we want to make sure we can demonstrate and document that our workplace is following the appropriate protocols. We're socially distancing. We're making sure that that people are not, coming in and, running around with no masks on, for example. We want to make sure that we have it in writing. Why? Because from other reasons, we want to make sure that we can prove that we offered the job back. Giving it in writing makes sure that we have an opportunity to show the Small Business Administration and the bank auditors that we don't have to count them for FTE reductions because they chose not to come back after getting a legitimate offer. And so We want to make sure we can document this to the EDD, for example. I think there's going to be a lot of people who find out after the fact that, you know, maybe I didn't qualify for unemployment after all, because I did say no to a recall, and the unemployment people now suddenly they want their money back. What am I to do? Well, that's their issue that they have to deal with. So we want to make sure we tell them, look, if you don't come back, you may not be able to come back later. In other words, we are under no obligation in most cases to hold anybody's job open so that they can, you know, feel more secure and use the COVID excuse, if you will. Again, I sound flip and a little snarky and sarcastic when I talk about this. And there may be people that are absolutely out there that are really at risk. And I don't use this snark for them. The snark is intended for others who are abusing the system. And I think we probably see both sides of both types of people on this continuum as we, as managers, try to manage our workforces. Link for the employerlawyers.com. Do you have any trouble? Sorry?
We lost you again.
Okay. I was talking about the employerlawyers.com website and the legal advice. We have some forms up there, some guidance that's available through that. If you haven't looked at it, do that. If you have questions, call. You know, John in particular has the patience of Job, and he's been walking dealers through this for the last 3 or 4 months, and there's no end in sight, so we're just strapped on, ready to continue it. So here's another one that we get questions about. I can't come to work because my family member is at risk. You know, I'm going to stay home to take care of my at-risk family member who doesn't have any symptoms yet. Well, the EEOC actually addressed this. California hasn't yet, but the EEOC did. And they said, look, do we have to accommodate them by giving them leave in order to stay home because they're afraid of a family member with a potential risk factor? The answer is no. The disability laws do not require that we accommodate a family member's disability in the same way that we might have to an employee's disability. But again, California law hasn't spoken on this. What do you think King Gavin's going to do when he thinks about it? He'll probably make another declaration. He'll wave his scepter around, and next thing you know, we've got a new accommodation requirement. So again, I apologize if I'm sounding too snarky, but that's the employment lawyer in me. Comes out sometimes. It's kind of like an FMLA request. You know, FMLA is a great law, but it's limited to specific things. If you don't put that square peg into the square hole, then you're not entitled to it. And so, you know, make sure that, you know, you don't feel like you're being forced around and bullied into things. But at the end of the day, if I had an employee come to me and say, hey, I'm a little bit nervous about going back to work. What do you think? Can I take some leave? If we have a personal leave of absence policy, I'm probably going to let that person take a personal leave of absence, right? I'll give them the form. If they can check a box that gets them paid, more power to them. If not, then that's between them and whatever savings they have saved up. Here's another one we hear sometimes. I don't have to do that. You know, wear a mask, what? Or submit to this protocol of symptom checking. You know, I'm a libertarian. I don't need to do that. Well, you know, I don't know that the virus can tell that you're a libertarian, and any virus you're carrying is not necessarily going to, you know, be all that kind to the people that you're around. So the rule is, look, if somebody says they don't want to do it or they can't do it, you know, you talk about, well, do we have a reason that we have to accommodate them? Is it a disability related thing? I can't wear that mask because I have an oxygen deficiency and I need every bit of oxygen I can. I can't wear that mask because, you know, I have a strongly felt religious belief that says that that masks are a figment of the Easteroni's imagination, and I can't go there. You know, whatever the explanation is, all it does is it triggers in us an obligation to interactive process with these people. What it is that, you know, what are your concerns? How can we avoid your concerns? Can we accommodate your concerns? That's what we're looking for. You know, maybe we can figure it out. Look, if you're worried about confidentiality of stuff, then don't tell us what your screening, you know, details are. Just say thumbs up, passed, thumbs down, didn't pass. You know, we can accommodate as best we can. We just want to, just like any other accommodation discussion, we don't want to be the one that leaves the table. If the employee and the employer are interacting and we're the one that's still there trying to be reasonable and the employee walks away, that's on them. If we walk away, suddenly we violated the rules and King Gavin's going to come after us. So again, the mask issue has become a political issue. All right. I found this the other day. Somebody passed it around Facebook. I've probably seen it 100 times in different sources now. And I'm not an expert on masks. I am not an expert on bees either, for that matter. But the bottom line is, you know, it used to be they said, look, you shouldn't do it. And then maybe now I'm kind of neutral on it. And then now it's just about every jurisdiction now has mask requirements of some kind. You know, LA, I don't think I can go in and buy a cheeseburger from a street vendor without a mask on, even if I could find one. So again, we want to make sure that we're following the guidance. The industry guidance on reopening talks about masks. Anybody that's been potentially exposed should be wearing a mask anyway. Most local jurisdictions always have it. This is an area where we can lead by example. It's also an area where, frankly, wearing a mask becomes the standard of care. And in a legal perspective, the standard of care is that minimum amount of attention to this that somebody has to pay in order to be able to say, hey, we've met our duty to keep our people safe. Even if there's no law that says you must wear masks, there is a law that says you have to keep your people safe. And so if you're not wearing masks and everybody else is, then you're probably falling behind the community standard of care. So we got to be careful of that. So that's all the slides I put together. I figured it would take me 25 minutes. Took a little long. We have some questions. Like I say, I am happy to continue to answer questions. I'm very appreciative of Alin to moderate those questions for me because my eyes aren't good enough to read the small print in the chat window. But for those of you brave enough to ask the questions, you know, we can either at this point we can either continue to have the questions come in through the server, or if Alin's brave enough, she can unmute people and we can take live questions. I've got plenty to do. All my favorite haunts are closed, and so you know I'm stuck here. So I'm happy to take as many questions. Those of you who are you know too shy or don't want to ask your questions today, or if you're like me and you think of the best questions after you log out from the meeting, because that's my style, then just write down the information. I'm just double checking to make sure I typed it in correctly. Yeah, those are the numbers. If you call the main number, you get the benefit of talking to Vanessa or one of the other staffers who's going to be able to direct you to any of our attorneys who might be available and able to help, not just me. I don't purport to have any kind of corner on the market in this regard. But please ask the questions. Go to my website, the employerlawyers.com website. Has a lot of resources that we put together. A lot of it's come you know, from our study and our review, but a lot of it comes from the fact that we have been counsel for the CNCDA and in the dealership world in California for decades. And we have a lot of institutional knowledge we want to take advantage of. And finally, those of you who are familiar with HR Hotlink need a little further introduction. That's another area where because of its focus on customer service, probably to the detriment of profitability at times. We keep up with a lot of the changes. The application that's on the phones that runs through there can be very handy. If you have questions about it, you can reach out to HR Hotlink directly or reach out to me and I'll put you in touch with the right people so you can figure out either how to look into it more or how to utilize it better if you've already got the service, for example. We'll make sure you're in touch with the right people. So Alin, with that, thanks for the opportunity again, and I'll take as many questions as people have time to ask.
Okay. So one comment I'd like to make about Hotlink, they are advertising a lot on our Adoma newsletter and on the website. So Hotlink or HR Hotlink, you can get the information from them on the website as well. So I'm going to go back because there were some questions about. Can we require them to bring a doctor's note clearing them to come back to work? Well, we asked that one, didn't we?
We did talk about that one. And at the end of the day, if you think that you're really, really nervous and feel like you need a doctor's note, bear in mind a couple of things. First of all, that you're going to have to do it with everybody. There's a level of consistency that you have to follow if you're going to go that route, okay. Right? There's probably most people that do this and they find themselves in a situation end up deciding that, well, I want a doctor's note from certain people, but not necessarily from everybody. So we just, if you're going to go that route, I would recommend that you call us and you talk to us specifically about why it is that you're concerned that, for example, the time-based return to work protocol is not sufficient to protect you.
Okay. And can we request a test result? So if they've taken a COVID test, can we ask them for the test results?
Okay. I have heard this one a couple of different times. The documentation we need, if somebody says, look, my doctor said I should isolate, the documentation we need there in order to be able to get that money from the government is simply, we have to be able to identify the doctor that told them to stay out. And so we don't need these doctor's notes. Again, consistency is going to be one of the rules that we have to follow. If we are asking some people to bring a doctor's note, but not everybody, then we're potentially in the trouble area. And if we're looking, for example, to require that people have two negative test results before they come back, we can require that, but we have to view it universally with everybody. And so like most medical related inquiries and examinations, it very much has to be work related. So if you're concerned enough about it that you are thinking you need to ask so-and-so for a doctor's note, then I would call the lawyers and get specific advice just to make sure on a case-by-case basis to make sure that you're not ending up actively or inadvertently playing favorites and not being universal in that approach.
Okay. The next question is, no longer do we ask the employees who have been exposed from a team member with COVID to self-isolate for 14 days of exposure. Can we still pay them to take a test?
Yeah, we can. Now, if there's symptoms, now one of the paid leave protocols is if you have symptoms and you're actively seeking to a diagnosis of COVID or not, then we can pay them and the government will give us the tax rebate, a credit for that based on our payroll taxes. But unfortunately, if somebody is just saying, look, I'm a little nervous and I think I should go get the test. I don't have any symptoms, but I should probably go get that test. Then if we decide to pay them, we can, but we won't be able to credit that from the government. So we don't get to take advantage of the FFCRA leave and the tax credits.
Okay. The next question is, how do we report to OSHA? Is it by phone or is there a form?
I don't know the answer to that. Can you hear me okay, by the way?
Yeah, we can now, yes.
Okay. My earpiece just finally died.
Uh-oh.
Apparently it won't let me talk on the phone all day long. So what was the question again? I'm sorry.
How do we report to OSHA? Is it by phone call only or is there a form?
You know, I have not seen a form for OSHA reporting. I suppose what I would probably do is Google OSHA and find out if they have it may be, for example, that they've opened a portal where people can just, log in and put in their company information and make the report. They may do that. They may not. For example, they may be afraid that too many people will be filing false reports or unauthorized reports and it'll swamp their system. But I'm sure their OSHA website would have guidance on how to let them know if there's been a disease incident. This is not a new COVID specific thing. If we have disease that's, other kind of infectious disease running rampant through our facility, then it's entirely likely that there have been OSHA reporting requirements beforehand.
Okay. The next question is, how do we get a hold of EDD to let them know someone refuses to be recalled for work. No one is answering the phone. Is there somewhere we can write what happened so they don't get unemployment?
Well, there's a couple of ways. One is that, you know, at some point they're behind. They're not doing it on the same frequency that they used to do it outside of the pandemic. But, you know, the EDD does follow up and say, hey, you know, is this person really not employed or are they really off work? And frankly, they're far enough behind now that by the time they reach out to you, it's entirely likely that you'll have offered work back to most of the employees that were off work, at least those that your prognosis of your business condition will allow you to bring back. And so there may be a website by now, a portal on the EDD website that allows this to happen. But I believe one of the resources that we have on our employer lawyers legal updates field is actually a form for sending to the EDD, for example, to confirm that we've offered a job and they haven't taken it.
Okay. One of the questions is, can you email this presentation?
Can I email the presentation? Well, I will tell you this.
We lost you again.
I'm probably going to look at it and do some spell checking before I, release it per se. But I'm happy to send it to Alin, and then she can distribute it further if that's what's usually done in these scenarios.
Well, what I did for the last meeting with the PowerPoint presentation is we attached it to, we are putting the meeting online for our paid members. And if there is an attachment, it's there. So they just have to be a paid member and have a login. So, that's where I have done it in the past.
I'll send a copy of the slide deck to you, Alin, you can distribute the normal channels.
Okay. And then the next question is, are temperature checks mandatory or recommended?
So it's mandatory that people are checking temperature. It's not necessarily mandatory that we as the employer check the temperature. So for example, if we as part of our symptom check, we ask them if they have a fever. And if they're going to answer that question, they should be able to know whether they have a fever, which means that people should be checking their own temperature. So it becomes, like a lot of stuff in this environment, it becomes a bit of a trust issue. You know, if people want to lie to us and tell us, oh no, I don't have a fever at all, you know, they're sweating bullets and got the clammy hands and all that, and you know, halfway through their shift, they collapse with, fever, delirium or something, then, you know, yeah, they've pulled a fast one on us, you know, and that might put us in the hot seat. But there is no obligation that we have that we take everybody's temperature. We can just ask them if they have a fever, if they've taken their own temperature. Most employers by now, supplies were a little light early on, but most employers by now have one or more thermometer around that people can take their own temperature with. One advantage of having them take their own temperature is that medical privacy is enhanced. So I would have them take their own temperature as much as I could.
Okay, the next question is, the symptoms forms that we have, the employees sign every day, how long do we have to keep these?
They also get temperature
checks every day as well.
I've got a book about documents that employers have to keep, and usually they say stuff like 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years. Medical records are tough to say. There's been not a lot of guidance on how long we're supposed to have all this stuff. So unfortunately, I don't have a good answer for you other than indefinitely for now. But I think we'll get clarity on that as it stretches into, you know, more months, and hopefully not more than that.
Okay, I have a question. We are a Hotlink client, and I am now trying to get all of my employees to take the survey online. And the questions that they're telling me are, well, basically you're telling me to lie, because if I say I have a headache, I turn red and it says to go home. And my answer to them is, if the headache is abnormal, if it's not something that you're used to, if it's something, then I'm not asking you to lie. I'm asking you to tell me, do you have a sinus headache? Do you have a headache because you drank too much? Or do you have a headache that you've never had before? If you're sick, stay home. Don't lie, but you know.
Exactly, We can't underscore enough, again, it's this reason rule that we talked about before. If it's symptomatic that you've had every time the jacaranda bloom, I get the weird coughs and sneezes, okay? Then, yeah, I get a headache during jacaranda season. I probably don't think twice about it. But what the symptom checker does is say, it makes you think about it. And it doesn't say, you know, go home and isolate yourself. It says, don't come in, call your boss, right? Call work, right? And so we should have a protocol in place that if they call us and say, hey, I came up red on the app today because I told them about my headache. Well, let's talk about your headache. You know, why do you think you got a headache? Well, I tied one on pretty tight last night and I'm a little bit hungover. I'm not going to lie. Well, it's probably that related. It's not related to COVID. Come on in, get your work done, as long as you're sober enough. You know, so it's very much a practical approach.
Okay. The next question is, we take the temperatures every day. Is it a pass-fail system good enough without keeping track?
It is. We have no reason to care whether someone's temperature is, up, down, whatever, in a specific way. As long as they're below that 100-point whatever threshold that we watch for. And so in a perfect world, we don't care to keep those kind of records. Pass-fail is more than enough for us. The only time where it might be, you know, significant is if your base body temperature is normally 72 degrees and you suddenly spike it at 82 degrees, that may be significant. You know, not everybody is 98.6 all the time. And so if there is an upward trend, even though it's below the benchmark, then it may be some significance. But the employee should be knowing this. If you're not used to a temperature that's that high and suddenly your body temperature goes up by 2 degrees, you're going to know it, all right? You're going to feel lousy because you're going to have a fever.
Okay. The next question is, part of our work site prevention plan for COVID asks each employee to do a daily self-check prior to coming to work, including temperature checks. So we have opted not to check them ourselves.
Sounds good to me.
So I'm telling everybody that they clock in and then they take their temperature and they do their survey. So you're saying it's okay to do it before they come in?
Well,
aren't I supposed to pay them if I'm requiring them to take the survey?
Yes, you are supposed to pay them. And so what happens is, you add an extra 3 minutes maybe onto the time. So those who take the survey before they come to work and punch the clock, you just need to find a way to add 3 minutes or something onto their clock based on whatever the reasonable length of time it is to take that survey.
Okay.
And unfortunately, the way California's wait an hour rules work, you can't really just wait and add, you know, a half an hour a week or 2 weeks or something on there. You have to kind of do it on a day-by-day basis because an extra 3 minutes at the beginning of Tuesday, that puts you over 8 hours that day, which we treated as overtime. And so you can't just lump it at the end of the week.
Okay.
Thanks, Davis.
Okay. Any more questions?
All right. Well, with that, I'll wave goodbye. And just to make sure everybody's cameras are working.
I got one more. It says, isn't there a difference between them doing it at home? Isn't there a difference between them doing it at home?
If they do the temperature check at home, it's still them doing something that we've asked them to do. We are in the words of the minimum wage rule, we are suffering and permitting them to do that work, whether it's at home or whether it's at the office or whether it's in the car on the way there. We still have to pay them for that credited time.
Okay. Oh, he's put question mark, question mark.
Yeah.
Let me unmute you and then you can ask the question. How about that? Okay, you're unmuted. Go ahead.
Is that for me?
Yep, that's for you, Jim.
Yeah, it's what we're talking about is that, Dave, is that the difference, because I was trying to type real quick. First of all, people are checking their temperatures at home anyway, and how is an employer going to monitor an employee they're checking it at home themselves anyway. My experience is that normally what happens is when the employer lines everybody up before they come into the workplace, you know, say, okay, guys, we're going to do this temperature check. They got to do that on the clock. You know, or like you said, it's going to be a wage and hour issue. But if somebody does it from home and they're double checking to make sure before they come to work, because the employer can ask them, okay, don't come to work if you're sick. So an employee that gets up in the morning and they check their temperature because of the fact that they're not going to come to work if they're sick, and your position is that they're going to have a potential labor board issue under that particular circumstance?
If we are requiring the employee to check their temperature or to otherwise run through a symptom check, then yes, we need to pay them in credit from that time. So if, let's say they check it and they have a fever and they can't smell and taste that morning. Uh-oh, probably COVID. I'm not going to work. I call my boss. I tell him I'm not coming to work. Right. So what we do is we pay them 3 minutes that day. We don't have to pay them reporting time because they didn't report and I send them home for no work. We have the work. It's just that they're not in a position to report to work. Therefore, we pay them for the 3 minutes that they did that hour's work, so to speak. And that's what we do. Now, like you say, a lot of them are checking their temperature anyway, and good for them. Why should we have to pay them for something that they're going to do anyway? Because California, there's no cleaner explanation. I wish I had one.
All right. So there's another question that says, ours only takes 5 seconds. As long as it takes to say hello in the morning, I don't think we need to pay them for everything. What do you think?
Well, if it's a 5 second thing, we would identify how long it really does take. If they're doing the symptom checking and they're going through the list, it probably takes more than 5 seconds. And also, once they've done it once and read all the fine print one time, it probably doesn't take 3 minutes every time either. You know, part of it is from a prophylactic standpoint, we want to make sure that if we're going to be wrong on an issue of a few minutes a day or a few minutes a week, we'd rather be wrong in the way that the employee is not harmed, because even a 25-second violation arguably could lead to PAGA penalties and a representative action that can be very expensive.
The Jim had typed in, if they're on the clock, it doesn't matter. And that's where, like for our dealership, everybody clocks in and then we take their temperature and then they do their survey. So they are on the clock. And they said, I just want to get it over with. I said, clock in and then do it.
Then they're being paid. It's no big deal.
Yes, right. I'm not paying them extra. I am paying them to stand there for 10 minutes and do the survey and get their temperature.
Exactly, because by now, all of your commissioned employees are paid a base hourly wage. All of your technicians and piece rate employees are paid a base hourly wage. You know, during that period of time when they're on our clock, we could have them go out and sweep the lawn, or we could have them take their, you know, health survey. So if they do it after they clock in, then we don't have to worry about adding extra time. But if we have them do it, say, for example, using an app before they come in, then, you know, obviously we should credit for that time.
Okay. Does anybody want to be unmuted to ask a question? If they say yes in the chat, I will unmute you. Okay, I guess we're done then. I want to thank Dave for taking the time out and thank everybody for joining the call. And hopefully I get to see or hear you guys all next month. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity. If, again, any questions, let us know. We keep our phones on to our detriment sometimes, but we're almost always reachable.
Yes. Thank you very much, Dave.
You're very welcome.
Bye, everybody. Thank you.